This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of radiocarpal fracture dislocation from the trauma section on orthobullets.com. A radiocarpal dislocation is the total loss of contact between the carpus and the radius. This can be purely ligamentous, which is rare, or it can be associated with a fracture. Treatment is usually internal fixation of the fractured bones, radiocarpal pinning, and repair of the radiocarpal ligaments. As far as the epidemiology of radiocarpal fracture dislocations, the incidence is 0.2% of injuries to the wrist. With respect to the demographics, males are affected more commonly than females, and dorsal dislocations are more common than volar dislocations. Again, dorsal dislocations are more common than volar dislocations. Risk factors for radiocarpal fracture dislocations are high-energy trauma. The pathophysiology involves high-energy shear or rotational force to a hyperextended and pronated wrist. Again, the mechanism of injury is a high-energy shear or rotational force to a hyperextended and pronated wrist. This is often due to falls from a height and motor vehicle accidents. Associated orthopedic conditions include open fractures, distal radius fractures, ulnar styloid fractures, carpal bone fractures, specifically of the scaphoid, lunate, and trapezium. Keep in mind that medial nerve injuries are more common than ulnar nerve injuries. Other associated orthopedic conditions with radiocarpal fracture dislocations can be an irreducible DRUJ with soft tissue interposition. Finally, these injuries can also be associated with intercarpal injury, specifically scapholunate or lunotriquetral dissociation. Distal radius fractures associated with radiocarpal fracture dislocations can be radial styloid avulsion fractures or volar lunate facet fractures. Radial styloid avulsion fractures involve the attachment of the radioscapholunate ligament, and volar lunate facet fractures involve the attachment of the short radiolunate ligament. Medical conditions associated with radiocarpal fracture dislocations include associated injuries to other organ systems, which are very common due to the high-energy mechanisms of these injuries. As far as the prognosis of radiocarpal fracture dislocations, with early treatment and appropriate management, good outcomes can be expected. Now, let's go over some relevant anatomy. Specifically, we'll talk about the osseous anatomy of the distal radius, as well as relevant ligamentous anatomy. The distal radius has an articular surface that is biconcave and triangular, with the radial styloid forming the apex of the triangle. The sigmoid notch forms the base and articulates with the head of the ulna, and the dorsal surface of the distal radius is convex and serves as the floor of the dorsal extensor compartments. The ligamentous anatomy include the radiocarpal ligaments, the capsule, the scaphoid and lunate fossa of the distal radius provide stability to the radiocarpal joint. The short radiolunate ligament is the primary soft tissue restraint against volar translation of the carpus. A short radiolunate ligament attaches to the volar lunate facet of the distal radius. Again, the short radiolunate ligament is the primary soft tissue restraint against volar translation of the carpus. And the short radiolunate ligament attaches to the volar lunate facet of the distal radius. The radioscapholunate ligament provides restraint against ulnar translation of the carpus. Again, the radioscapholunate ligament provides restraint against ulnar translation of the carpus, and the radioscapholunate ligament attaches to the radial styloid. The ulnolunate and ulnotriquetral ligaments originate on the volar side of the TFCC, which inserts into the base of the ulnar styloid. Now, let's go over the classification of radiocarpal fracture dislocations, and this is the Monheim classification and the Dumontier classification. The Monheim classification has two types. Type 1 is a radiocarpal fracture dislocation without associated intercarpal dissociation, and type 2 is a radiocarpal fracture dislocation with an associated intercarpal dissociation. The Dumontier classification has two groups. Group 1 is a radiocarpal fracture dislocation that is purely ligamentous or involves only a small cortical avulsion fracture off the radius. Group 2 is a radiocarpal fracture dislocation associated with a large radial styloid fracture fragment involving at least one-third of the scaphoid fossa. Patients with radiocarpal fracture dislocations present with a history of a high-energy trauma to the wrist. Common symptoms include pain and swelling of the wrist, as well as numbness and tingling. Physical exam should involve inspection, motion assessment, as well as neurovascular evaluation. Inspection may reveal a radiocarpal deformity based on the direction of the dislocation, that is, whether volar or dorsal. Inspection may also reveal ecchymosis and swelling, as well as a pale and cold hand. With respect to motion assessment, make sure to document flexion extension as well as pronation supination, and any crepitus should be noted. As far as neurovascular assessment, again, remember that median nerve injuries are more common than ulnar nerve injuries in the setting of a radiocarpal fracture dislocation. Remember that radial and ulnar artery injury is common due to the deformity which causes arterial occlusion. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include a PA view of the wrist, a lateral view of the wrist, and a, quote, teardrop view. The PA view of the wrist shows the radiolunate alignment. And remember that normally two-thirds of the lunate articulates with the distal radius, and in complete radiocarpal disruption, the carpus translates ulnarly. The PA view of the wrist in the setting of a radiocarpal fracture dislocation may also show intercarpal widening, and make sure to evaluate for scapholunate or lunotricuspid dissociation. The PA view in the setting of this injury will also show a break in the gelula arcs. Remember that the radiocarpal, proximal midcarpal, and distal midcarpal arcs should be collinear. The lateral view of the wrist will clearly show a dorsal or volar radiocarpal wrist dislocation, and the lateral will also show loss of collinearity of the lunate with the articular surface of the radius. The teardrop view is a 10-degree proximal view on a lateral, and you will use this view to evaluate for a lunate facet fracture. A CT scan is indicated to evaluate the articular surface in cases of severe comminution and articular depression. MRI is indicated to evaluate for the integrity of the scapholunate and lunotricuspid ligament. The tested differential for radiocarpal fracture dislocation is a lunate dislocation, otherwise known as a perilunate dissociation, and the other diagnosis on the tested differential is a distal radius fracture. Treatment for radiocarpal fracture dislocation can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes close reduction and cast immobilization, which is indicated for patients that are not medically stable for surgery, and those patients that have a stable radiocarpal joint after close reduction. As far as outcomes of non-operative management, historically there have been satisfactory outcomes for purely ligamentous injuries. Operative options for a radiocarpal fracture dislocation is open reduction, internal fixation, and radiocarpal pinning, as well as ligament repair. This is indicated for irreducible radiocarpal dislocations, as well as an unstable radiocarpal joint after reduction. As far as the outcomes, good outcomes can be achieved with concentric reduction of the radiocarpal joint, treatment of intercarpal injuries, and sound repair of the osseous ligamentous injuries. To go into the techniques of the management of radiocarpal fracture dislocation in a bit more detail, close reduction will involve longitudinal axial traction of the digits, and then casting for up to 6 weeks should be done to allow for ligamentous scarring. Open reduction, internal fixation, radiocarpal pinning, and ligament repair can be approached through the volar approach to the distal radius or the dorsal approach to the distal radius. The technique should involve provisional radiocarpal joint reduction, three-column fixation, decompression of neurovascular structures, and then addition of external fixation and or a radioulnar pin for 4 to 6 weeks for unstable injuries after fixation. Three-column fixation involves the radial column or the radial styloid, the intermediate column or the lunate facet, and the ulnar column, which is controversial. Fixation of the radial column should involve a K-wire, compression screw, or plate fixation, whether dorsal, volar, or radial, of the radial styloid. Fixation of this column should also involve soft tissue or possible suture anchor repair if the injury is ligamentous, comminuted, or the fragment is too small for fracture fixation. As far as fixation of the intermediate column or the lunate facet, you should use a screw or tension band wire loop fixation of the lunate facet. Again, soft tissue or possible suture anchor repair can be done if the injury is ligamentous, comminuted, or the fracture fragment is too small for fracture fixation. In addition, fixation of the intermediate column or the lunate facet can involve short radiolunate and radioscaphocapitate ligament repair. Ulnar column fixation is controversial. This is indicated for DRUJ injury or persistent instability after fixation of the radial and intermediate columns, and this can be done either with a screw or tension band wiring of the ulnar styloid fracture or ligamentous repair. DRUJ reduction can be done either closed or open, and then percutaneous pinning should be done in mid-supination. Again, this technique should involve decompression of the neurovascular structures, as well as addition of external fixation and or radial ulnar pinning for 4 to 6 weeks for unstable injuries after fixation. You can also use a dorsal spanning bridge plate instead for additional fixation. Some complications to be aware of include acute carpal tunnel syndrome, stiffness, post-traumatic arthritis, chronic radiocarpal instability, as well as late intercarpal disruption. Risk factors for acute carpal tunnel syndrome include a delay in treatment, and the treatment of an acute carpal tunnel syndrome is, of course, a carpal tunnel release. Stiffness has an incidence of 30 to 40% of the total arc of wrist flexion / extension. Risk factors include prolonged immobilization, and treatment includes manipulation under anesthesia and or hardware removal. Risk factors for post-traumatic arthritis include a non-anatomic reduction of the articular surface. And finally, risk factors for late intercarpal disruption include occult injury to the intercarpal ligaments. That's all for this review of radiocarpal fracture dislocation. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.